All right, welcome back to hour two of the 100th edition of the FBH Lounge. Your dignitaries who are in the house here, Rick Morris, Walter Payton, of the two of us, I, Rick Morris, am the one garishly outfitted in the tux here this evening. Thank you very much. Also, busting out the 300 ring for the occasion as well here. Just nothing is too good for the occasion here tonight. The dignitaries on the phone lines, Nate Noy and FDH Senior Editor Jason Jones. We have a gentleman joining us for this next segment here, and I've really been looking forward to this since Jason and I first started to envision this. We talked about this a little bit before the break, told you who he was, a little bit about him, gave you Jason's impression of him from having talked to him out there at DenverSportsRadio.com, as he did repeatedly. He wanted to make this guy a regular guest because he enjoyed having him on so much. When I told Jason I wanted to do a segment like this, this is the guy he told me we needed to get, and I'm sure his judgment is going to be vindicated. I speak, of course, of John Binet of the Mile High Report, and you can, of course, find out where we have it linked to at milehighreport.com. John, it's a pleasure to have you on here tonight. You, a fellow resident here of the North Coast, good to have you on the program. How are you tonight?
Great, guys. Thanks for having me, and I hope I can live up to all that hype you just dropped. So I'll do my best, but I'm glad to be here, and yeah, a Northeast Ohio resident for sure.
Yeah, you know what? And one of these times here, I'm sure, you know, we'd love to have you back on with us here, and you're one of the people that we can actually have on potentially in studio here. A lot of our guests, you know, nationally, we don't have the option of doing that. It'll be nice to do that and get to meet you personally here at some point. Let's take you as our guest and feed you the first one here. I just want to look at this on a philosophical level here tonight and get you guys having some different thoughts on some different matters here. And just kind of compare notes and see where we're at on this. The first one that I have here, and I don't know that we're going to get to anything more than what we have listed on the website. I have a few of them listed, and we got about 15 to 17 minutes to do this. So the ones I have listed might be the entirety of the ones we end up hitting. First question, and I'll feed it to you first, John. The NFL, increasingly in recent years, a win-now league. Just these draft picks have to come in, have to contribute almost immediately. I think that's one of the reasons we've seen quarterbacks slide from time to time in a couple of these drafts here. Teams are drafting on need. It's win now, et cetera. So in a win now league, how do we end up in a situation here, John, where more and more teams are moving to the 3-4 in a league where almost no colleges are churning out 3-4 ready players? Guys like Cameron Wembley are having to be projected as a 3-4 outside linebacker, Vernon Golston, et cetera. We've seen that. Some guys have been able to make the transition, some haven't. Colleges aren't setting guys up for this. It's almost like colleges aren't providing the right kind of education, you know, in other fields of life. You could almost kind of make that comparison here. But for the NFL purposes, what's your take on this, on a league where, unless you're rating somebody from the Patriots or the Steelers or a successful team in free agency, you're not getting a guy you know can play the 3-4?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I think what you're seeing is a lot of hybrid tweener types in colleges today, because I think college football coaches, as scholarships continue to get reduced, I think you're seeing college football coaches going after athletes more than physical attributes, meaning, you know, a certain height, weight, you know, that sort of thing. They're going after athletes, and they're thinking, you know what, if you give me an athlete, I'll plug them in somewhere on my football team, offense or defense, and make some things happen. And I think what you're seeing in the NFL is a little bit of the same thing. You know, they'll take – Vernon Golston's a great example, a freak athlete, but the guy just doesn't understand NFL defenses, especially a defense like Rex Ryan. So he struggled to kind of, you know, is he a defensive end? Is he an outside linebacker? Well, those are two totally different positions in the National Football League, where at Ohio State it was Vernon, attack the quarterback, and that's what he went and did. So I think you're seeing – you know, teams like, you know, you mentioned the Steelers, the Patriots, even the Broncos now with Josh McDaniels coming from that New England system, they're going after intelligent football players, some guys that may not be athletically the most gifted in the draft per se or grade the highest, but these guys are, you know, guys that are getting 43 on the Wonderlic test, like Eric Decker, the wide receiver from Minnesota, did that the Broncos drafted. They're going after intelligent football players because they feel, you know what, all these guys are athletes. I'll take guys that I know can learn this system and learn how to play different positions, multiple positions, and I'll be successful. So I think that's what the successful teams in the NFL are doing. they're kind of ignoring just the physical attribute, the physical specimen, and going after more the intelligent player. Because like you said, college football is not teaching these guys the NFL game. They're teaching them more of a gimmick style because that's what wins in college football.
Well, that's interesting. And when you're looking at, you know, projectable type players in terms of attributes and in some cases mental attributes, that's an interesting way of projecting as opposed to the literal thing of a 4-3 guy coming into a 4-3 system. Now, that's a very interesting approach that McDaniels and some other people are taking. Jason, I'll segue to you next for this. Well, what are your thoughts on, you know, you and I have had some conversations off air about this 3-4 and a 4-3 and the fact that, you know, almost nobody's coming into the league ready for this thing, you know, especially in a league where if you're going to be like a 3-4 defensive end or even a 3-4 tackle and just be kind of like a space eater, that's a situation where, you know, it's really hard to find guys in college who literally fit that bill based on their body of work.
Yeah, it's you know, for me it's frustrating because I see the guys that have the size, speed, intangibles to play those positions, but like you mentioned out of the gate, most of these universities are not playing that style of ball. Now, the interesting thing is, as we saw last week in the NFL draft, there were just as many ready-to-go 4-3 nose tackle or 3-4 nose tackles as there were 4-3 defensive tackles, say, in the first 40 picks. So maybe we're starting to get a little bit more like the NBA where teams are going to start drafting on potential more so than body of work. But it's the other positions that are more intriguing. As John mentioned, the hybrids, and I can only assume we're referring to the defensive ends turned outside linebackers, the fact that it seems like a 3-4 inside linebacker is in fact different than a 4-3 middle linebacker. Ultimately, I'd like to see more of these colleges and universities just go that way, because not that it's their responsibility to groom guys for the NFL, but if it works in the NFL, why is it not work in college? Would be my next question.
Yeah, and it would seem to me that it might almost be the flip side of what you see, where guys like Charlie Weiss, when he was at Notre Dame, could tell kids, hey, I'll get you ready for the pros. You'll be in a pro-style offense. You know, if you were one of the few major institutions running a 3-4, that might be a selling point too. Hey, you know, this is going to be a good spotlight for pro teams for you. Nate, how do you see this? I know you're somebody who me and you have just had countless times off air talking about X's and O's and the schematics of football and everything like that. How do you see an issue like this and you know the contradiction of a league that is obsessed with guys contributing right now, whether it be for salary cap purposes or otherwise, or maybe it's just the general win now pressure, dealing with a situation where if you're running a 3-4, you're having to project like a mother on these guys.
Yeah, but I think it's already been, the nail's been hit on the head, Rick, that you draft the guys that are the smart players that have the physical skill set. If these are smart guys, to me, it doesn't really matter what system they came up through. They are adaptable. You know, I mean, if they're as intelligent as you and I are and they've got the football skill set, I think they can fit in. You know, the coaching in the NFL is, you know, the best coaching in pro sports probably with everything they do. And, you know, if a guy's young and eager and willing to do it the way he's told, I don't see it as big of an issue. I don't think that, you know, the 44 games they played in college, 48 games and, you know, 40 games in high school, those 80 games, you know, it's not an impossible transition for those players to change into the new system and just to do it the way they're told, as long as they have that intelligence level and that natural skill set to complement it.
Okay, all right. So it's not anything that they're, you know, given it's like a tattoo on the forehead that they'll never get rid of. Okay, they can transition out of that. That's an interesting point there. I'll start the next cycle here with another question set up with you, John. This is something where I think Jason and I have talked about this off air a couple of different times here too, that this bygone notion in the NFL, we almost never see this anymore outside of what Tampa Bay did earlier in the decade with Mike Alstott here, of having a fullback who can actually contribute as more than a blocker. You got a lot of guys that are, you know, borderline guys. Certainly somebody I think like Jerome Bettis was big enough to play fullback, but the teams he was with never chose to use him in that way, particularly when he was with the Steelers there. It would have been interesting to see Parker and Bettis a lot of times on the field at the same point in time. Why do you think it is, John, the teams have shied away from this, and you basically only have one guy out there? The interesting thing is your Broncos might be the exception to the rule in this. Like when you had a Peyton Hillis or a Mike Anderson, sometimes they would line up at fullback. So maybe I'm asking the wrong guy, but I think you would agree, by and large, that doesn't really happen anymore. Why are these guys that are borderline size worthy of playing fullback not put there to be able to give greater flexibility for teams with their offensive packages?
You know, I think it's twofold. One, I think the number of players coming up that are willing to do what a Moose Johnson did in Dallas. I think the number of guys that are just willing to do that, to just sacrifice themselves essentially, is dwindling, almost like the natural center in the NBA. You know, guys coming from Europe, seven-footers like Dirk Nowitzki decide, you know what, there's money in shooting three-pointers and staying outside. Forget this banging down low stuff. So I think part of it is that. And secondly, the NFL of today is, A, a quarterback league, and two, it's a matchup league. So instead of putting two guys in the backfield where defense can very easily account for those guys, you know, let's spread these guys out. Let's get them out of their base package. Let's get them in a nickel. Let's get them in a dime. And let's throw the ball all over the field. We've seen it with the Patriots and some other teams. You know, the Colts, for instance, going three wide with a tight end like Dallas Clark that's not a blocker. He's a fourth wide receiver out there. So the National Football League is trending away from, you know, the 3 yards and a cloud of dust mentality and the power football mentality. I mean, the good teams can still do it. But, you know, the New Orleans Saints won the Super Bowl with Reggie Bush and Pierre Thomas not doing a whole lot of ground and pound. It was more, you know, flash and dash. And I think that's what the trend in the NFL is, and that's why the natural fullback, you know, it might be a thing of the past for now. Now, everything in the NFL is cyclical, so I'm sure a team will bust it back out and bring it back around. But like you mentioned, the Broncos, you know, Mike Anderson, converted halfback. Reuben Drones, when he went to fullback, was a converted halfback. Peyton Hillis, you know, was really a fullback at Arkansas because of the two guys behind him. So when the Broncos played him, he was more of a halfback and more of a ball carrier when he went to Arkansas. You know, so it's a combination of just the trend in the NFL and then the number of guys that can actually, you know, understand blocking schemes and want to play that position. You know, a guy like Spencer Larson that's playing fullback, quote-unquote, for the Broncos now, is actually a linebacker. So those guys that are that size can go on the other side of the football, much more glamour position, and, you know, make more money.
Well, that's a very good point here, too. When you start to get into specialization, you know, and that's something that just has been afflicting all sports, you know, in recent decades here, you know, narrow roles that people get pigeonholed kind of into. I could see that playing a role in this. Jason, what are your thoughts on this as far as fullbacks and, you know, why we're not seeing more teams try to embrace the notion of the old school fullback? I know we'll never see a Jim Brown lead the league in rushing again from the fullback position, and that's fine. I understand that the game has evolved towards the scat backs, if you will, and that was even before the Brian Westbrooks and the Chris Johnsons came along. Ultimately, mobility has become the most important thing there, but why teams are willingly sacrificing the notion of having two guys in the backfield who are legitimate threats to carry the ball, what are your thoughts on that, Jason, on why that is?
Well, you know, as many times as we've had this conversation, and everything John said is really the reason this conversation evolves back around. And my concern is not so much utilizing a traditional fullback or a block-first guy who has the ability to carry the ball, but you always hear analysts refer to this man's NFL is a league of two running backs. You have to have two good backs in your system. It just seems more often than not you have the featured back and the change of pace back or the red zone guy or whatever. And my inquiry is more based in the New Orleans model or the Carolina model, which would dictate, in fact, that if you're going to have two backs, why can't they both be legitimate, and New Orleans maybe not so much, but legitimate featured backs in their own right, or at least in their college career, and bring them over and then bring the question back around to the original question, why can't we have them both on the field at the same time? Why can't I see D'Angelo Williams and Jonathan Stewart at the same time, thus creating some sort of a matchup issue in that as long as the formations are set accordingly, that theoretically the defense wouldn't know who's going to get the ball. And in that analogy, both backs being able to catch the ball and run in space would absolutely be a huge benefit. So as the NFL has evolved, I just get the impression that even though we're evolving towards something different, teams are still reluctant to try something truly creative.
Yeah, I think that definitely is the case from the way that it's going here. Nate, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, something like what Jason just described, that to me is infinitely less radical than the Wildcat. And yet, Tony Sperano conceptualized it, put it out there. Half the league's ripped it off in one form or another, more than half the league, I think. If the league will embrace something as radical as that, Nate, why not what Jason was just talking about?
Well, because, Rick, and it's great because John pretty much hit about 80% of what's really going on, but what's the root cause of all this, Rick? Is so many times in big sports, it's money. What's marketable? What sells tickets? Fullbacks don't sell tickets, Rick. Nobody comes to a football game to watch the fullback. Nobody turns on a Sunday to watch the fullback. It's a quarterback league. It's a flash league. It's a touchdown league. That style of game doesn't put up the points they need to have to keep the momentum going for the money, for the fan base, and that's what's change the style of football in the NFL. It's the glamour aspect, and there's nobody that cares to see a fullback. And you factor in, you know, your stars are the quarterbacks, and like John said, nobody wants to be fullback. Nobody wants to go out there and block for 40 plays a game and get one or two handoffs. The guys that are talented aren't going to take that role. And again, the machine of money is pushing for that role to be non-existent into the future. And I don't know if we ever will see this come full cycle. I think the fullback may be a thing of the long past. I'm not sure we're ever going to see it again in the NFL.
Okay. That's an interesting point, and I would have I should have expected that there might be some, I'm not going to say conspiracy oriented, but you know, quasi conspiracy oriented angle from you there about selling tickets and merchandising and whatnot. I'm not saying I disagree with you necessarily. I'm just saying I knew I could count on you to think of something along those lines.
It's all about the loot, Rick. Like, yeah. Kevin Garnett said, it's all about the loot.
I know you so well, buddy. I should have known you were going to go to that thing. And like I said, I'm not saying I disagree with you. I'm just amused that I should have been able to predict your answer a little better. All right, next.
But John took all the good answers, so I had to come up with something.
Hey, you got a compelling one, Nate, and that's what it's all about, is being compelling here. All right, I guess we got time for two more cycles of questions here before we go. The last one's kind of a little more open-ended for you guys, but this first one here, I'll start with you, John. I'm curious why you don't see more coaches really try to dictate to the other team as opposed to being dictated to. Some of the really daring ones, but it seems like they're the guys we know, you know, by name, like Mike Martz. It just seems to be such an exception to the rule. You also see the same thing in the NBA a little bit. The most radical instance of what I'm talking about, 2002 season, good old Botch Davis, worst coach in the history of the NFL. The Steelers get blown out by New England and Oakland running the spread on them. The Browns, with their four deuces, quote-unquote, the next week here, you would have thought would have come out trying to do the same thing. Butch Davis goes into a shell, says afterwards, well, I'm sure they would have been ready for us. I'm sure they would have made adjustments based on what happened to them the last 2 weeks. Now, that's the most radical example that I can name of somebody doing something like that, but you still see a lot of examples of that, of teams who are so scared of something like that. It has seemed to be like a radical thing the last couple of years with Rich Rodriguez in college here, that hey, maybe you can run out of these spread formations sometimes here. You know, you have less blockers, true, but you're dictating the defense. The defense might be coming out in a nickel or a dime position, and it's easier to run on them in that way. It still seems to be such radical thinking, John, in terms of we're going to dictate to the other team instead of being dictated to. And I'd like to know why you think so many coaches still choose to just play it so safe.
Well, one is, you know, a lot of these guys don't have a lot of job security. And you kind of started this segment off talking about the NFL being a win-now league. And a lot of coaches in the National Football League are on a week-to-week, season-to-season, at best basis. There's a few exceptions, and those are the guys you see taking more of the chances. what Sean Payton did in the Super Bowl with the onside kick, you know, to start the second half. Bill Belichick going for it on fourth down deep in his own territory is a prime example. The guys that know they have job security, that have the confidence to make a risky decision, a risk reward type decision, because they know they're not going to get fired if it backfires on them. Those are the guys you're going to see try different things and try new things. Now, as you know, kind of going back to that college to pro, and the Broncos are kind of going through a lot of that right now with Tim Tebow and the offense he ran in Florida, and you know, the spread, the pure spread offense as it's run in college, you know, by Rich Rodriguez and by Urban Meyer at Florida, it's a gimmick offense. It's not an offense that I believe wholeheartedly would work in the National Football League, because defenses in the NFL are much faster and much smarter than those in college, even in the SEC where a lot of the teams are good. You saw Alabama, a pro defense run by a pro football coach, you know, and Nick Saban, stop that offense. And in the National Football League, if a team decides we're going to run the pure spread and spread everybody out, you know, you may see a team has success against some of the lesser teams, but a Bill Belichick or, you know, those upper echelon defensive-minded coaches would find a way to stop that very quickly. And it might get you 20-20, but you wouldn't score consistently when you need, you know, to grind out yards in the red zone or in third and fourth, you know, in short yardage. So I really believe that it's not so much a question of, you know, dictate or be dictated to, more so that sometimes, you know, and you're seeing a little bit of it with this wildcat or wild horses, and you see all these different iterations. It looks great and during the regular season. It's a lot of fun, and people have fun with it. You know, Ronnie Brown running all over the place. Then you get to the playoffs, and Baltimore comes to Miami, and all of a sudden, Miami can't move the football, and they get blown out in their own stadium in the playoffs. Good defenses will stop gimmick football. So in the end, you still have to be able to run, to get short yardage, and to do things in the red zone, you know, without going 3, 4, 5 wide and spreading the ball all around. I mean, that's my point of view on it.
Okay, interesting answer. Challenging the premise. Good stuff there. Very, very thought-provoking. Jason, what are your thoughts on this whole matter of dictating versus being dictated to?
Rick, do you need a moment to collect yourself after the little Miami Ravens comment there?
Yeah. By the way, John, my second, I'm a Browns fan, but my 1A team is the Dolphins, so you did dredge a terrible memory there. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jason.
No, I think what John's hitting on is it's just one of those things that when we sit back and sever the tie between sports fan and presumed sports analyst, we try to come up with these answers. That is one of the answers that we try to, you know, disavow and believe that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that everything could eventually come down to something like job security or the fact that it might not work. It may be fun and sexy now, but when it matters, is it going to do the job? Because in the root of things, And it stretches far beyond just coaching, but in the root of football specifically, it's a boring game as far as the stuff that wins. All the time you hear people say, especially GMs, they go that route, that we want to build from the inside out. We want to start in the trenches. Well, on draft day, when you've got a 38-year-old casual football fan is watching his team on the clock in the first round, he doesn't want to hear, you know, EU Potty or Mike Pouncey. He wants to hear Dez Bryant or CJ Spiller. You know, that part of the game is not sexy. But if you want to win and do a good job and keep your job if you're the coach, sometimes you have to do those less exciting things.
Okay. Yeah, sometimes it's not always about the glamour side of it. Okay. Nate, your thoughts on that, dictating versus being dictated to?
Absolutely, Rick. First, I want to add that your number one hate team would probably be the Steelers. Your number two hate team in Cleveland has got to be the Ravens. So a double whammy for you on that event. But,
yeah, and no offense to John, but going back to my childhood, the Broncos are up there as well, John Elway and whatnot.
Beautiful. You know, Rick, I think about football, and I love those chess match games. And I know you don't like them, but I love them. And I look at football like a chess match almost every time out, you know. And you can't make a radical move in chess and leave your king exposed. Well, it's clearly a game of inches. and one or two mistakes in a football game, it's over. You might survive one turnover. You might survive one mistake. You make two mistakes in a football game, you're beat. The coaches have to approach it like chess. They have to counteract the other team's moves each time there's a move made. And they have to take the conservative route for that, because you just can't take the chance of making that mistake and losing the football game because of one or two mistakes, 1 or 2 inches. And so many times an NFL football game comes down to that. And that's why the odds makers, you know, for games could never beat the NFL, because it's just too close to call every single time. And that's what makes it so great is the, you know, the chess match mentality of a football game.
Well, you know, and it's funny. I mean, I love the chess match, too. You and I maybe kind of differ maybe semantically on what that is. I've said that I hate, like, the 13-9, you know, field position type, you know, 15 punts in a game kind of a thing. I'm not saying I don't like 49-42. I don't like no defense either. But I like moderate to high scoring. You know, you've said you're more comfortable with that kind of game. Different strokes for different folks, I suppose, here. All right, bringing it around to the final question here. We're running slightly behind, but I'm just letting this segment breathe because it's so damn good the way that we're going here. I wish we had another hour for this. But here's what I want to put out there for you guys. I'll start with you, John. We've seen a decade. We talked about a few of these things here a little bit. Some interesting innovations. The spread, the Wildcat coming into parlance. The cover two really got to be a big thing here with what Dungy started to do in Tampa Bay, Dungy, Kiffin, et cetera, and the way that it's kind of spread through the league here. We've seen some really interest. For those of us that are connoisseurs of X's and O's, we've really seen some interesting developments over the last decade. Start with you, John. Off the top of your head, what do you think some of the biggies are looking at the next 10 years here as far as developments to come into play?
Well, you know, that's, again, you know, I always look at football games, like I said before, it's a cyclical type, you know. So, you know, the 3-4, you know, was huge in the 70s, you know, the Steelers and the Broncos, and the Orange Crush was a 3-4 defense. And then it kind of went away, and you saw the 4-6 come around and some other, you know, specialty-type defenses and specialty-type offenses, and you saw the run and shoot. And then, you know, football kind of got back to its roots a little bit with the running game, you know, and then Barry Sanders and some other guys. And then it's now a complete quarterback league. And if you don't have Peyton Manning or Tom Brady or now Drew Brees, then you're really, you know, under the gun. So I really, when you look at the NFL, it's the ultimate copycat league. And the latest trend is going to be whatever the team that's winning football games is doing. So you're going to have teams looking at the Colts, and they're looking at the Saints now, and what are they doing? So everybody's going to probably go sign an aging safety like Darren Sharper that can, you know, return a bunch of interceptions for touchdowns and lead you to a Super Bowl. So, you know, I don't think there's going to be any new type of trend, because I don't think that's what the NFL in the NFL, college football completely different, but in the NFL, what really wins, and I think, you know, Jason kind of touched on this. What really wins is that same hard-nosed, you know, smash-mouth type mentality. Why the Steelers, again, here in Cleveland, bringing up a sore subject, but the Steelers have been so consistent for 40 years because they do the same thing every year, and very rarely have they gotten away from that. And that smash-mouth, we're going to run the ball down your throat, we're going to play tough, you know, tough nails defense, you know, we're going to make things hard on you on defense, and we're going to run the ball down your throat on offense. Here it comes. Stop it. And more often than not, teams can't, because they try and get, you know, cute and fancy and flashy and try and do it a different way. Well, sometimes the old way is the best way, and I think that's what we've seen in the NFL.
Well, good stuff. Good stuff. I'm a student of history in sports and outside of sports as well. I love the whole thing of, you know, there's nothing new. It's all just stuff that's been replicated from before. That's really what the Wildcat is. The Wildcat's not new. The Wildcat is ancient and dusted off and presented in 21st century form. Great answer there, John, when you're talking about what to look for in a macro sense, things being recycled from before. Jason, try and follow that, buddy.
Yeah, I'd have to say I agree with everything there. But I got to say also that a part of me is searching for something. And I don't know that I've seen it yet, and I don't know that I ever will, but in the discussion of the 3-4 defense and its popularity, and assuming that it continues to grow and other teams eventually transition over, thinking that the grass is always greener, I want to see what I can only describe as a hybrid 3-4 or a hybrid defense where we've accepted the fact that, you know, lighter defensive ends that are quick, fast, and can shed blocks make great outside linebackers. Well, if that's true, then why have we not seen someone take advantage of the idea that a 3-4 defensive end is generally not going to get sacks, and their job really is no more than to eat up blockers, push the pocket back, and create lanes for the linebackers. So in that regard, I want to see a 3-4 defense where you have a nose tackle, sure, in the 330 to 340 range, but I also want to see the, quote, defensive ends be 4-3 defensive tackles who know what their job is, and their job is not to go wide and use swim moves, but instead to smash that pocket back in the quarterback's face, thus creating lanes for linebackers and blitzing safeties, to the point that it seems feasible to me that if you can do that, if you can eat up the entire offensive line, including tight ends, with three guys, four at the most, there's no reason that I don't think that you can't blitz on every play while still covering everyone on every play to some degree. Do I think it's logical that it'll actually happen? Absolutely not, because we come back to football games are won in the trenches, and everything that is not traditional smash-mouth football is more or less just regurgitated, repackaged versions of old things that have failed in the past. So I don't think I'll see it, but I sure as hell would love to.
Oh, snap. I challenged you to follow that, and you did. Good one. Good answers there. Nate, tee it up, buddy. What do you think? Look into the crystal ball, and what do you think schematically the league's got to offer?
No, I think John just hit the nail on the head. I mean, think about what happens every year in pro football, Rick. You know, the teams that make the Final Four, so their systems all get rated every year. You know, some the bottom feeders get let go, and the teams that make it a long way, their coordinators and assistants get rated and become head coaches, and it's cyclical every single year. Whatever works for the top teams, the next year the other teams are implementing that because they've rated the coaching staff, they've rated the style. So I'm not sure how far you can really look ahead, Rick, because it seems like, you know, it's going to be a consistent one-year-at-a-time change where you start taking these coordinators, offensive and defensive, and put them on other teams, and then another team rises to the top, and then their people get merged back into the bottom, and that's just the way that the NFL works. So, I sit here and I think, well, I don't know what's coming next, because what works next year will be what's implemented the year after. What works the year after will be implemented the year after that. So it's kind of a one-year-at-a-time thing as far as I see it.
Good call. Because, yeah, I mean, the Wildcat came in like mid-08, and, you know, before you knew it, everybody was scrambling, looking for a version of it. This was something, again, like I said, I wanted this to be on our 100th show. I wanted to have, you know, something here tonight where we could just kind of flex our brains and have at it and put it out there. And this, collectively, I mean, fellas, to me, I think it lived up to what we wanted to do. I can't thank you guys enough. I get the sense you guys probably agree with me there that it did everything we thought it would do and hoped it would do.
Absolutely.
I definitely appreciate the opportunity. Being this close, I'd love to get in the studio and hang out and talk some football for sure.
John, we'd love to have you. We'll take advantage of having you here in Cleveland, and we'll do it. And you know, I want to talk some micro level football with you as well. You know, certain teams, certain situations. But for this philosophical thing we wanted to do tonight, you were the guy Jason pointed to for me, and I always trust his judgment completely. And things like this, that's why I do. So, just a pleasure. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks a lot, guys. Thanks, Jason. We'll talk to you later.
All right. We'll have you back, and definitely with us, John. And as we're going to be going to break and catching up with Evan Roberts of WFAN in New York on the other side, got our dignitaries here, the two of the originals, Jason Jones, our FDH senior editor, and Nate Noy. And again, guys, you know, you've been here for the ride on the first 100 ones and contributed in any number of invaluable ways here. And, you know, onward and upward as this thing continues to go. Thanks for being such a big part of tonight as you've been through the first 100.